Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Marianne Wiggins, whose latest novel is The Shadow Catcher. Earlier novels include Evidence of Things Unseen, John Dollar, several other books. Marianne Wiggins has lived in several different countries, but now lives in California. I understand that The Shadow Catcher is the first of a series of books about California, is that right?
Live in Hope, yes. The book that I'm writing now, I'm placing in Owens Valley, and it will be about the water wars and the building of the Los Angeles Aqueduct.
I found two really interesting quotes that you've made over the years. One of them is that, quote, "Nothing will make me live in Los Angeles." That was a few years ago. And then more recently, "L.A. is more horrible than Las Vegas. That's why I want to live there."
16 years I lived in London. Being mercenary about this, I didn't get a single story out of that city. And to some extent, I am always looking for stories. I have a rich interior life, but it helps to have a stimulus from outside. And I just find Los Angeles that abrading stimulus, that little particle of sand in the soft pulp of my existence that just irritates me, just keeps me awake, just keeps me alive. I think part of it is probably that I've reached a point in my life. I'm 60 years old, so I'm happy in my existence. I don't need to find a place that's going to make me comfortable. I know who I am. I'm comfortable in my skin with what I do for a living. And so having that little abrasion stimulates me.
The book itself operates on multiple levels. There's a character in it named Marianne Wiggins. There's another character in it, Edward Sheriff Curtis, who's a real photographer who lived around the turn of the 20th century, and it concerns his relationship with his wife and his family, and there are parallels between that and Marianne Wiggins' relationship with her family. Originally, when you were doing the research, did you think that the novel that you'd be writing would be solely about Curtis, or did you know from the beginning that you'd be doing this parallel story?
Your instinct is correct. I set out to write an historical novel, and I say that in the most loving way. I'm more comfortable writing in the past. Evidence of Things Unseen was about the interregnum between the two world wars and the making of the atomic bomb. John Dollar took place in the 19th century, if my memory serves, in Burma under the Raj. And so I find that the immediacy of writing contemporary fiction, the way that our language seems to be more brutal somehow, in a rush to prove itself. So I'm much more comfortable existing in the historical sense. Once I got started on Curtis's story, I realized that I wanted to write a lot about how we perceive images and the way that photography frames our reality, and that in order to access modern photography, I was going to have to bring it up to the modern age.
It struck me that one of the things you were attempting to do is that in the fictional novel, The Shadow Catcher, which is completely an historical novel in the book that Marianne Wiggins is about to sell to film, in that the question is asked, why did Curtis stop photographing Indians at a certain point in his life? Mm. The response is, that's what the book is about.
Why did he stop? I think this is the most important question. This is an almost life-defining obsession that he had. He thought that he was going to be able to go out and photograph every tribe west of the Mississippi, that's 80 tribes, in a period of 3 to 4 years. When he sought his original financing from J.P. Morgan, he had projected that it would take him 5 years to complete this. It took him 30. And he didn't complete it. At the end of those 30 years, he had run out of money. Morgan had cut the spigot off of money. He was destitute. Morgan demanded of him that he turn over all the copyrights to J.P. Morgan and Company. Curtis was left depleted, exhausted, old. He was in his early 60s. I'm in my early 60s, but it was old for him. He was out of energy, out of money, and out of hope. His wife had divorced him, and he had a bit of a nervous breakdown. He disappeared for 10 years. There's no trace of him. Nobody really knows where he was. Rumor has it that he had a breakdown and was hospitalized in Colorado. He went off and searched for gold in Nevada. He went a little crazy, I think, Richard, out of sadness. And then in the last decade of his life, he lived into his 80s and died in 1952. in the last decade of his life, he did a complete reversal and became absolutely dedicated to his four children, lived with his daughter Beth. These four children he had abandoned. He hadn't seen his youngest child until she was 18 years old. But he became committed to sort of reinventing his fatherhood with them. He made them breakfast. He cooked eggs for them. And he found some easy way to ease himself into death because he had been so disappointed in every other aspect of his life.
When you were working on the research for what you thought would be solely a historical novel, this question came up. Was part of the reason you changed the way the book was constructed was because there was really no way to answer the question under those circumstances?
I'm sure there were multiple ways to answer. Yeah. There always are. There isn't this a single, you know, one answer, in fiction at least. I'm not talking about reinventing the genome. And there were multiple ways, but as I got into knowing him and his relation with his family, the issue of his way of parenting and the manner in which he absented himself from everyone he loved started to stir memories of my own life. I've never written autobiography. I've never written autobiographically. I don't base characters on myself or members of my family. But as I said, and I keep harking back to my being 60, maybe I should see a psychiatrist over this, that it's appropriate now for me to start to include myself. People who have read my books over the last three or four decades, I think, start to have a curiosity about who is this woman? How does she come by this point of view? How does she know what she knows? And so I started to think about adding my own experience with a patriarchal figure, my own father, whom I loved very much and absented himself from my life. I started to see parallels between him and Edward S. Curtis as a father. And then the story just, once I had built those two lanes, the story just proceeded down the two-lane highway as opposed to the single-lane highway.
Well, you know, you never escape autobiography if you're an honest writer, which means that through the, 10-odd novels that you've written already, there are threads. I mean, if someone were to read all of them, they could get a pretty good idea of who Marianne Wiggins is.
Absolutely, you could connect the dots. You could connect the dots between my prejudices, my clear political outlook, my favorite words, my favorite colors, the way that I build a male character or a female character. I'm sure it shows who I am. And oddly enough, men disappear in my novels. I don't kill them off necessarily, but they do tend to absent themselves. And so there was an awakening for me that I realized, maybe I'm doing this because of something that exists in my own life.
Marianne Wiggins, let's talk a little about some of the elements in this book. The opening chapter takes place in Hollywood with Marianne traveling on the freeway. Very, very funny sequence, which I believe is probably coming out of your head exactly. There's no fiction there.
No, I didn't add any extra twists and turns to Route 101. Actually, that's not the first chapter. The book opens on an elegiac talk about a sketch by Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Which sort of sets the tone of looking at maps and looking at territory. And then it goes to a funny scene of Marianne Wiggins on the 101. It's kind of a road book, and a lot of my interpretation is about the myth of being on the road. Particularly, I talk a great deal in the book about the Mother Road, Route 66.
Is there any way, I think, to write about Hollywood that doesn't wind up funny?
You can either go funny or noir. Those are your two choices.
Why did you feel the need to include that chapter? Because you never really get back to it.
I simply used that meeting as a way to introduce Curtis that was the springboard into which, and then I followed the Curtis route as opposed to following the producers back to Armani.
The travel, since you brought it up, I put down a list here of the travel sequences in The Shadowcatcher. Mm-hmm. We've got a slow freeway, we've got a train cross-country, a rowboat, hiking up mountains, we've got a fast freeway to Las Vegas, we've got Route 66, we've got the backseat of a car traveling through Virginia. The book is all about movement.
And opens on movement. As I said, that opening little, I don't even know what to call it, a sort of sketch, a word poem about a sketch of Leonardo's that I saw at the Queen's Gallery, which is a map which he had drawn from way up high, about 2 miles up, and dreaming of flying and whether or not we're hardwired to fly or to dream of flying. And so it is about movement, which anyone living in the West thinks about, because we're at the edge. You don't move very much further than this. You've gone as far as you can, and if you have not found, as the Joe family in Steinbeck's book, if they haven't found that promised land by the time they hit California, they're going to run out of turf. And that really speaks to an aging process, because I think as we get older, if you have not found that peace with yourself by a certain age, you're also going to run out of turf. So that served as a metaphor, I think.
The sections on Curtis, from the perspective of his wife, Clara, from before when her parents die up to her marriage in the first section of the two sections devoted to that, how much research did you do into Clara? Was there much to do?
The question should be, was there much to find? Because there was a lot to do in trying to find it,
There
wasn't a lot to find. And I wanted to tell the story from her perspective, also as a metaphor for Curtis's point of view. Curtis took a certain lens to American Indians. He ennobled them. He elicited or solicited their personalities, but the personalities were always serene and noble. He did that on purpose because at the time that he was taking these photographs, it was the worldview that they were savages. It was the worldview that they needed to be assimilated into Christian society. And it was the worldview that they were not going to survive.
There's a point where I think it's you, Marianne, either speaking to the reader or talking to Hollywood people, making the comment that, in fact, he was a propagandist. Not too long ago, I interviewed Stephen Bach about Leni Riefenstahl. There's a comparison to be made in that while Riefenstahl's movies, Olympia and Triumph of the Will, look like documentary, they're really not. They're staged, much in the same way that Curtis, before her, staged the Indian pictures.
Very much. And I think in both their cases, everything that Leni did, she did about Leni. And the same can be said of Curtis. He went into these communities. At the time that he photographed the Indians, they were already living in impounded concentration camps. There's really no other way to talk about a reservation than that. They were destitute. They were ridden with disease. They were exiled from mainstream American culture. It is thought commonly when you look at a Curtis photograph that he went in on horseback with a wagon behind him. He drove there in an automobile. This was at the beginning of the 20th century. He paid the Bureau of Indian Affairs to get onto the reservation, and he lined the pockets of the Indians with money to pose for these photographs. So he basically was ignoring the reality of their existences by dressing them up. He was a society photographer. That's the way he started in Seattle. So he knew how to take a pretty picture. He basically manipulated their reality for a beautiful image that he could sell. It was all about Curtis. But going back to your question about Clara, when I decided that I wanted to frame the book through her eyes in the same way that Curtis framed the Indians through his eyes, I tried to find everything I could about her. Her maiden name was Phillips. I went through death records on the internet, ancestry records, tried to find out exactly who she was, who her parents were. The image that you get in the book is entirely fictive. I made up the circumstances of her parents. I gave her a brother that she never had. And I used her life as a way of elevating the story of this woman, because women, on the whole, have been excised from mainstream history.
The other section of The Shadow Catcher concerns your life and your fictive life. It's my guess that the circumstances of your father's death are true.
They are.
That he was, in fact, found by a milkman.
That's the legend that I have. I think I address it in that way.
Right, yeah.
That is the story that I have been told.
And the other part of the story is fictional.
The legend is that his body was found by a milkman in a national park, Shenandoah National Park, where my father had killed himself. I don't know that as to be a fact, and there's no way that I can find out. I've tried. And so I play with the idea that there might have been another story. There might have been another way that he died. And that becomes the story that's in The Shadow Catcher.
And the story of the elderly black man is fictional.
Yes. In The Shadow Catcher, I create a man who actually discovers my father's body. And And I thought about, I mean, I know that my father's body was discovered by someone. Well, I'm a writer of fiction, so naturally I think about the impact of that event on that individual. Did he just turn around and walk away and go on and live a happy life, or did this have ramifications? So in my fiction, I made it have ramifications. I made one circle of events encircle another series of events.
It seems as if the mystery of your father would be the central mystery of your life.
It
Why
is.
He left and
it is.
What happened.
It was for a long time. I think now I've put it in a state that I am serene with. I've managed to explore all of the variables in a way that leaves me with sort of no quote-unquote unfinished business.
Then let me ask you, do you suspect that the reason that you give for Curtis's changes in his life might have been what happened with your dad? I don't want to go into detail for people who read the book.
I don't, it's hard to draw such parallels because they were such different types. You know, I have only so many resources as a novelist. One is the facility of language, skills that I've assumed through a vast reading on my own. At the heart of it, my primary resource is my own experience and my personality. And this is the first book to which I have brought those in the forefront.
You're listening to an interview with Marianne Wiggins, whose latest novel is The Shadow Catcher. Coincidence plays an enormous role in this book. I've talked to people who've said that coincidence, like in your novel, happens in real life. However, in a novel, if you have those kinds of coincidences, people tend to think you're manipulating.
This is a great literary tradition, and to a large extent, particularly in the beginning with Fielding and Tom Jones, those coincidences begged a suspension
right.
of, I mean, we really, could that possibly have happened? It is my temperament to employ the elements of coincidences in all of my storylines. I don't know why. Maybe I read coincidental books when I was a child, but it is part of my bag of tricks that I pull out again and again and again in my stories. Highly improbable, yes, but I'm hoping that the characters that I've created will carry them through.
In terms of writing the sections that take place in Vegas, you went to Vegas
yep.
and toured around. Did you find it easy or hard to separate the fictional Marianne Wiggins and her perceptions from yours, or did you kind of just say, this is me, and I'm going to put myself in a fictional situation?
I think the voice of the character called Marianne Wiggins in her episodes in this book is very close to my conversational voice. We're getting close to galleys and discussing the placement of the photographs through the novel. I mean, there are almost more than 20 photographs through the novel. This is the first time I'm using that device as well.
And that's from Siebold.
Yes, it is. I have to directly say that. Well, first of all, it's from reading textbooks. We're all educated with the placement of crucial photographs. So that antecedent was already there in one's mind. But Siebold was an enormous influence on the way that I designed it. And I designed the placement of the photographs. But when we were talking about the map of the book, my editor would start to talk about a part of the book and say the smart Marianne is what the smart Marianne was, the Marianne that she called who wrote the Edward and Clara bits. The not smart Marianne, the dumber Marianne, was that conversational Marianne who speaks to contemporary event. And I think now that you've met me and spoken to me, you will find that voice in the Marianne sections is very much the way that I speak vernacularly.
There's also a lot of anger in that Marianne.
Is there?
There's an anger that seems to seep out in the observations about the world, in her comments toward her sister. I saw it. Maybe you didn't.
Then that's a big blind spot. My perception is that the book ends on a resonant note of hope and one of great acceptance.
I think the anger goes away as that Marianne begins to look into the background of the man who stole her father's identity. But in the earlier sequences, it's hard to say what it is. It's probably directed toward your father, I would think.
I'll tell you, Richard, it's so hard to write female characters because I can get away with a lot of sassiness as a person because seeing me in the flesh, you see a plasticity in my face. I grin a lot, and I make it clear through my body language that I am not out to castrate you. You know, I'm not an angry woman. But when you take those words and put them boldly on the page without the human presence, particularly in a female voice, a lot of that comes off on
as
reading,
anger.
And you're reading it in your male voice. You're reading it in Richard's head,
right?
In your voice, and it is a very instructive. Thank you for that. To just watch, because I might have to say, comma, end quote, she said with a smile on her face, or she said leaning toward him with a, you know, with a smile in her eyes.
Well, why do you think that is? Why do you think it's harder?
I think because most language that is stated self-confidently in society, we are used to hearing from the mouths of men. Look, Hillary Clinton is up against it as well. We as women have acquiesced to the male gender for the neutral pronoun. I freely refer to humanity as mankind. I don't have a problem with that. I don't need to say man or womankind. I'm over that. That doesn't mean anything. But even when I'm just saying I'm over that, I was using my hands, I was being friendly, but if
right.
I were to put that on the page, I'm over it, you know, it would look angry. So I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that most of the language that we come to use in the 21st century was polished and refined in the male voice in the preceding centuries. And for women to own it is still being forged in that fire.
Well, I think it's interesting now, as you talk about that, realizing how careful you had to have been in writing Clara to make sure she did not come across as angry, even though on some levels, of course, she is.
She has a lot of reason to be angry.
Oh, sure.
A lot of reasons for that. And possibly the reason, now this is another interesting point, is because I was making sure that that her voice and the words that she speaks in the book contain no anachronisms. It might just be the modern use, that kind of rapid, modern 21st century way of speaking that encapsulates that sense of masculinity.
It's also important to make sure her voice and the voice of the writer of the book, of that section of the book, is not Marianne Wiggins,
yeah.
The conversationalist.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little, Marianne, about your career as a whole. You were married out of high school. That means that you took a different route toward writing. Do you think that helped you or hurt you?
I don't look at it that way.
Okay.
Because I can't reinvent that. I think on the help side, on the pro side, it left my sense of voice opened to free discovery. I was a complete tabula rasa. There was just nothing. There was no received information. I did not receive the canon through a college education of what was regarded as necessary literature. I sort of created the literature that I elevated as my own. So that's the plus. The minus side is that because I am self-taught, there's a lot of holes in there. I mean, it's like a moth-eaten lace. There are things that I should have read and should have been taught that I wasn't, and that I'm just catching up with now in my later years. It's human to imagine, what if? Where would our lives have taken us if we had done this other thing? And I think that all of us play with that. Hell, that's a lot of fun.
When you married Salman Rushdie, this was before his, you know, world fame, if you want to call it that.
Oh, no. Salman had already written.
He'd already written.
He'd have written Midnight's Children.
Midnight's Children.
And Shame. And that little Nicaraguan folio that he did, that was his most recent book when we met, Jaguar Smile. He had pretty much taken the United States by storm with Midnight's Children.
And at that point, since you were still more of a struggling writer, did the disparity bother you at all in those days?
No,
days?
It didn't.
No?
I don't weigh that kind of power. You know,
right.
I fell in love with the guy. So that was not, it was, no, that wasn't, it's an issue, and I go back to the Clintons. Well, that's not the perfect example, because I think they have a certain Machiavellian deal going. But inside a unit forged in love, that doesn't play to the heart of what the relationship is about. That is an exterior force in the way that the outside society looks at a couple joined together. So from the inside, I wasn't having those emotions. All the noise was coming from the other side of the glass pane.
And then, of course, came the fatwa. And aside from on a, you know, many levels destroying the marriage, because, frankly, how could any marriage survive those kind of circumstances? Do you go back and try to find some fictional way to deal with your own emotions of what went through, do you think?
I'm sure I have. I've written about relationships as the core of my last two books. In Evidence of Things Unseen, there's a, I think, a gorgeous marriage that ends tragically, but not because of something that happened between the two people. For me personally, I think I'm far more forgiving than I was. I might have naturally become more forgiving in my 60s than I was in my 40s.
Oh,
who knows?
Sure. Yeah.
But I think directly, no. I have an aversion to using those circumstances in my fiction at this point. It's too new. It's only 20 years, but it's still, you know, it's still sort of percolating. And also, we've now become caught up in a rerun of the Crusades. And to write about the impact, I mean, the fact that Salman was protected by Scotland Yard almost seems antique now. It seems as though that couldn't happen today.
Well, you said before we went on the air that Scotland Yard did not want you around. What did they expect you to do?
They didn't want me around. In fact, Salman and I had to fight for me being there. I was an American citizen, for one thing. So they had no remit. They didn't want me to be in the way. And it was clear that should anything occur while we were under their protection, their mandate was to get Salman out of the situation that was dangerous. And we would have meetings where they would say, we will leave you behind. We will come back for you if we can. But you have to understand, if you slow us down, we're all about saving Salman. And that was agreed and that was understood. As it turned out, it was actually good to have, first of all, a non-Brit in that company. People were not expecting an American to go out and do the grocery shopping. I could change the color of my hair. I could talk with a southern accent. And I actually had a lot more freedom. They needed somebody to do all the provisioning. I actually had a great deal more freedom to hide in the open than Salman could. Salman can't hide in the open. You take one look at Salman, and, you know, there's nobody who looks like him. And so he was, you know, it was very difficult for him to go anywhere, to be seen anywhere, whereas I had a great deal of fluidity, not only as an American, but as a woman.
Well, he said that he was, during those years, he was hardly able to write at all. Were you able to write?
He did write. He kept a journal, I know that. And the proof of the matter is he did write. I mean, look what he's published since that time. In the first year, no, nobody could. I mean, all of one's energies were focused toward lobbying for release, for one thing. There was always the possibility dangling in front of us that Khomeini may retract or change his position. In the beginning, it was particularly colored by the fact that there were still British hostages. And the primary concern of the British government was Terry Waite. And to make sure that, on the one side, Rushdie did not do anything that would endanger Waite's survival and existence. And once the hostages began to be released, then that changed the whole negotiation on the hand. So, I mean, there were so many aspects of it that were taking up one's energy. Where are we going tomorrow night? What are we, you know, how can we arrange to see Zafar? How can I stay in touch with my daughter? All of that there was just not enough hours in the day and not enough adrenaline in the system to be able to write.
Well, when I spoke with him not long ago, he takes the view now that he just happened to be the wrong writer in the wrong place at the wrong time, in the sense that Khomeini's power was beginning to ebb and he wanted something to put him back in the forefront. That's what Salman has said to me now. But at the time, it couldn't have felt that way.
That's a complicated question. Let me answer it on the levels that it deserves. First of all, there is no way that either one of us could ever imagine that Salman is the wrong writer at the wrong time in the wrong place, because nobody writes the way Salman does. He is a voice that has come out of the darkness and that addresses issues that no other writer was addressing. So I think part of that was modesty on his part. He remains a giant. You couldn't confuse him with Don DeLillo. No other British writer, Martin Amis, was not going to end up with a fatwa on him. Nobody writing in Great Britain with Salman's reputation, which was massive at that time. In Great Britain, he had won the Booker. He was at the forefront of English literature and happened to have been perceived by Khomeini as a Muslim. Let's not denigrate his reputation or to say that he's a minor writer, that ain't, or that he's interchangeable in any way, because he ain't. The second perception wrong person, wrong time, wrong place, is absolutely true and something that we always felt. The fatwa was issued in 89, 10 years on the cusp of the 10-year anniversary of Khomeini's rise to power over the Shah. And he was fading, and there were, you know, demonstrations in the street. He needed something to focus on. And in comes an imam from Great Britain saying, look, there's been this book published in Great Britain called Satanic Verses, and it maligns the prophet. What do you want to do? And, you know, wrong writer, wrong place, wrong time. The book did not deserve, under any circumstances, the attention that it received from Khomeini. Any other book could have just passed under his pen at that point. So that's where I think that perception comes from.
Well, Salman now says that many Muslims who even followed Khomeini have had a chance to read the book, and now they like the book.
I can't comment on that because that's information that you have from him, and right. I don't know that. But I'm sure that if he says so, that it's true.
Eventually, for these kinds of reasons, your marriage ended and you came back to America. You came back to America finally on November 8, 2000.
Yeah.
Which must have been quite a shock to come in at the time when the entire electoral system, it fell apart.
As it happens, the reason that I chose that day to fly was not only because it was election day, but it's my birthday. So I came back on my birthday, got off the plane in Los Angeles, and asked the customs guy, who's the president? And he said, I wish I knew, lady. And little did we know what we were in for.
You say at the time that you were shocked by the veil of complacency, smugness, and disinformation that you saw, which means that for you, returning from Britain at that point, America had descended into something you did not expect.
I had been gone for 16 years and hadn't been living with the brand of news that we have. The news in Europe and in Great Britain is far more complex and in-depth, less focused on celebrity, less focused on commercial aspects of the news as an industry. It's changing now because I think that we've created a monster in this country which is overtaking the way that news is presented in other parts of the world, at least in other parts of the English-speaking world.
When you saw what was going on, I mean, I know that if I leave the country for 2 to 3 weeks and then return, it's like I've come back into an alien environment. You suddenly see the propaganda you've been missing for 3 weeks. It's very curious.
That's why I am now a professor at the University of Southern California. And I'm a proponent of youth traveling. Leave the country. Go see other parts of the world. And the shocking thing, and one of the reasons that we have the president that we have now, who performs the way he does, is he never traveled outside this nation until he was president of the United States and his father was ambassador to China. I mean, please, how insulated and manipulated can he have gotten?
A friend of mine spends a lot of time in Thailand, and he said to me that because, of course, Thailand is a military dictatorship, in quotes, and in comments to someone there, you know, he said, well, you're living in a dictatorship. And the friend responded, well, you really don't understand that you people in America just aren't free.
No.
You think you are,
but
you're not.
I know, it's not understood. So everybody, get into the sky and travel.
And yet you've come back and now you're writing about California.
I've sort of made an assessment of my life and decided that I am an American novelist. I'm ready to write about where I live. From the same interview from which you're quoting, I think I said I feel like I'm in my Philip Roth years. And, you know, Philip writes in his barn in Connecticut and travels into New York City when and if he wants to. And that's pretty much the way that I'm living now. I live a solitary life. And I feel that I have too many books to write within my lifetime, and I have to be very selective about that. And I've chosen my territory.
Do you see yourself going back to style that is more just historical fiction rather than multiple storylines?
I see myself writing what's going to keep me awake. I have to be excited to be able to tell the story. And if the story is served through traditional linear narrative, and it's served well and the best way that it can possibly be served, that's the one I'm going to choose.
Then let me ask you this in relation to that. When you were working on the research and trying to create that other Shadow Catcher, was this your way out of kind of a closed box
It was a way of expanding the metaphor, because the Marianne Wiggins character is actually trying to catch the shadow of Curtis, who tried to catch the shadow of the Indians. So it seemed to me, yes, it was not a closed box. It was a sketch by, you know, who's the guy who has the beginning that comes to the end? Escher. It was more of an Escher-type sketch.
Marianne Wiggins, you've lived 16 years in London. Now you're back in the States. It's 6.5 years since you returned. When you look at America today, are you optimistic?
Yes, I am, but I'm also daily faced with people in their 20s at the campus at University of Southern California. The students that I have impressed me enormously. I wouldn't normally meet 20-year-olds. My daughter is 40, so I don't see 20-year-olds. They're frightened. The attacks on American continent have formed their lives and shaped their lives in the way that the assassination of RFK and JFK and Martin Luther King shaped mine. They're aware, they're alert, they're socially responsible. I know that the perceived take on this generation is that they're selfish and spoiled. I don't see that. I'm in those classrooms, and I don't see it. And they give me optimism for the future of the United States.
Marianne Wiggins, your next novel is about the Owens Valley and a fight for water. Have you thought at all about the ones beyond that?
No, but to quote a mantra that was in one of my former novels, taken from a sign in a French train station, and since trains are such a part of my romantic view of the United States, one train may hide another. And it's like seeing the mountain behind the mountain. At this point, all future books are cloaked by the mass of the book in front of me. But I do know, Richard, that there is a book behind that one, and I will find it eventually.
You've been listening to an interview with Marianne Wiggins, whose latest novel is The Shadow Catcher. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.